Chapter 37 of the Autobiography of Lord Alfred Douglas. This Legimus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. Chapter 37. A year after I sold the Academy, I became a Catholic. During the time I was editing the Academy, I was a High Church Anglican, and I ran the paper from that point of view, as far as religion was concerned. From the time I went up to Oxford right up to the time when I became editor of the Academy, a period of about 17 to 18 years, I had really no religion. I was what most Englishmen actually are, whether they admit it or not, a pagan. I am not exaggerating. I saw the other day a table of statistics which gave the number of people in England outside the Church of Rome who went to church on Easter Sunday last year as 7% of the whole population. Soon after I started editing the Academy, I began to get contributions from Mr. Arthur Machen. It was these contributions of his which first sent me back to Christianity. I gave Mr. Machen a perfectly wonderful show in the Academy. I printed columns from him week after week. I even reproduced in the paper, in weekly instalments, a whole book of his called The Views and Opinions of the Reverend Dr. Stiggins, a fiercely ironical attack on Protestantism, and paid him for it, or rather Sir Edward Tennant paid him, at the full rates on the highest scale for contributors. Mr. Arthur Machen's way of showing his gratitude for what I did so successfully to bring his name before the public was to write the obituary notice of me in the Evening News when that journal published a false report of my death in 1921. What changed me from High Anglicanism to Catholicism was simply that reading history and finding out all the lies that had been taught to me as truth at school and at Oxford convinced me that the High Anglican position, however attractive it may be, does not hold water. The theory that the Church of England is a branch of the Catholic Church and that the continuity was never broken at the Reformation seems to me to be demonstrably false. I held it for a long time, and abandoned it, reluctantly, only because the evidence was too strong for me. What finally converted me to Catholicism, though I did not actually become a Catholic till more than a year after I read it, was Pope Pius X's encyclical against modernism. This stately and magnificent piece of argument was, I suppose, sent round to the papers for notice. At any rate, a copy of it was sent to the Academy. The original is, of course, written in Latin, but the copy I got was an English translation. I thought of sending it out for review, but picking it up and reading a few lines, I became interested, and took it home to read myself. It had the effect of convincing me that the Catholic Church, in communion with the See of Peter in Rome, is the only true church. I definitely made up my mind to become a Catholic, but I put it off chiefly because, as appears from what I have just written, my conversion had come entirely through the intellect. I felt no emotion about it. On the contrary, I felt in some ways that to become a Catholic would be a tiresome necessity. I would have avoided it if I could. At any rate, I thought, there is no particular hurry. The emotional side of Catholicism did not reach me till some time after I had been in the church. When I first joined it, I was cold about it. The ritual, although I always liked it and thought it beautiful, did not influence me in the very slightest degree, nor has it ever done so to this day. When I had been a Catholic for about 18 months, I underwent the most violent persecution, which lasted, on and off, for at least 10 years. The result of this persecution was to force me deeper and deeper into my religion. For years it was my only support and consolation in a succession of almost unbearable miseries. Instead of being cold, I became very devout and mystical. I lived on reading the lives of the saints, and such mystics as St. Teresa and St. John of the Cross. I got to the stage of glorying in the persecution I was undergoing, and regarding it as a special sign of grace, which, of course, it undoubtedly was. I even had supernatural experiences, but I cannot speak of them in this book, except in one instance which I'll refer to later on, though I am not definitely sure that it was really supernatural. It is with deep regret that I say that I am now less devoutly religious than I was during those years. I have never, as far as I know, fallen out of a state of grace, and I am just as determined to live and die a Catholic as I ever was. But the wonderful feelings I used to have gone. So have the supernatural experiences, and though a priest in confession told me that this was simply because I no longer needed them, and that it was greater merit for me to go on simply being a good Catholic without them, I believe in my heart that this is not really what has happened. The fact is that, at the time I am speaking of, I intended to become a saint, which was a perfectly laudable ambition at any rate, however hopeless it may have been. Now I do not want to be a saint, I am afraid. When one considers this, it is enough to make one shed tears of blood, but that is the plain truth. Perhaps I shall change again. Meanwhile, I have become, I fear, much more worldly than I was during those terrible years when I was, apparently, hated of all men, and persecuted and even cast into prison more than once. The persecution began with the attack on me in Ransom's book, inspired by Robert Ross. I have already dealt with this case, and I do not want to become tedious to my readers by going into details of all my various actions at law. My quarrel with Ross began about 2 years before Mr. Ransom's book, Oscar Wilde, A Critical Study, appeared. All that happened was that I made up my mind, after various incidents and in view of information I had, that I did not want to go on knowing Ross, and that I did not choose that he should come to my house and associate with my wife. My reasons for this were that I had grown far less tolerant than I had been before my marriage, and even for some years later, of the sort of things which Ross boasted publicly of doing. I did not want to have any open quarrel with Ross, but I wanted to drop him. However, he refused to accept this. I had given orders to my servants at my house, 26 Church Row, Hampstead, a beautiful Queen Anne house which belonged to Eton, my landlords being the provost and fellows, that if Ross called, we were always to be not at home. Ross came once or twice, and was not received. He thereupon wrote to my wife and demanded the reason why he was refused access to our house. My wife gave me his letter, in which I detected an undercurrent of insolence and menace. I was very angry that he had written to her. If he wanted to write at all, I thought he should have written to me. I wrote back and told him, in a letter which I have no doubt is still preserved, or was at any rate, as long as he was alive, that as he insisted upon forcing me to tell him why I did not wish to keep up my acquaintance with him, I would tell him that it was because I no longer care to associate with persons like yourself who are engaged in the active performance and propaganda of every kind of wickedness, from socialism to sodomy. Ross made no reply, but I heard from various sources that his rage was extreme, and that he stated openly that he was going to get even with me. I treated these threats with utter contempt, rashly as it appears, for it is always a mistake to undervalue one's enemy, as Ross himself was to find out before the end came. I had not the slightest idea that Ross had a quantity of my old letters to Oscar Wilde, nor, if I had known it, would it have made the slightest difference in my conduct, and, badly as I thought of Ross, it never occurred to me for a moment at that time that he was capable of such villainy as he actually put into practice. I also, obviously, knew nothing whatever about the unpublished part of De Profundis. When I read Ransom's book, I immediately determined to take proceedings. My wife, as she reminded me only a short time ago, was strongly against my taking proceedings. She and I will never agree about what happened, and the attitude she took then, or when she left me. Not on account of anything connected with Ross or Oscar Wilde, but as the result of my attack on her father, which, yet, I must say, was made at least as much on her account as on my own. All I wish to say here is that, although her leaving me just before the Ransom action was a frightful blow to me, and really took all the heart out of me, and caused me to throw up the sponge when her father prosecuted me for libel at the Old Bailey, I entirely exonerate her and acquit her of any intention or desire other than to do what she thought was right in a very difficult situation. Although at the time I felt exceedingly bitter about it, what has happened since has proved that she never really turned against me in her heart. Those who still think that I made a mistake in taking proceedings against Mr. Ransom, and that all would have been well if I'd simply ignored the libel in his book, which most people would not have noticed, as it did not mention me by name, ignore the whole nature of the attack on me and what was behind it. If I had ignored the libel, it would simply have been repeated more boldly and more openly as time went on. Everything that happened in my life after the Ransom case followed logically and inevitably from that case, including the ultimate smash-up of Ross. The Ransom case, though of course I did not know it at the time, was simply the first battle in a campaign in which, in the long run, I ended by driving all my enemies out of the field. It was losing the Ransom case that made me take the fearful risk of publicly and persistently libelling Ross till I forced him into the open to prosecute me. Looked at in the proper light, the ultimate result of the Ransom case, with all its apparently deadly knockout blow to me, was that I afterwards smashed Ross, defeated the Evening News, and put Colonel Custance and Sir George Lewis out of action. Sir George Lewis's firm, Lewis and Lewis, were the solicitors against me in all four cases mentioned. Omelettes cannot be made without breaking eggs. I had to go through the humiliation and the chastening and hardening effect of losing the Ransom case before I was turned into the tempered steel which was more than a match for all this formidable group of enemies, even hampered as I was by extreme poverty in a fight against unlimited money. In short, if I had not sued Ransom for libel, I might as well have committed suicide, as far as any prospects in this world are concerned. End of chapter 37.